Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's March 27th, 2022, and welcome to episode 253 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, Wonder Twins, and 1953, I guess. Something like that. We were talking about the Wonder Twins, and then realizing most of us know about half of the information that one needs to talk about the Wonder Twins. So, anyway, I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined by three retro computing enthusiasts this week. We have Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing well. However well Carrington is doing, I'm that plus one.
All right.
Preemptively beaten.
Also joining us is Carrington Manson from Toronto. How is Earl doing?
Earl is doing amazing. That's what I say. Amazing. Way to go, Earl. Earl is the rising tide that lifts all boats. That's what I say.
Fantastic.
I am all boats.
And also joining us again is Michael Mulhern in Sydney. How are you?
Potentially wet. For the folks watching this, this is the creek down the back of my block.
That's an Australian euphemism.
Certainly is.
Yeah, the image behind Michael might as well just be like a lake.
The Amazon.
Yeah, it does actually sort of look... That seems about right. A river of the Amazon size. Well, it is good to have you. Good morning to you.
Yeah, glad I could make it. Looking forward to turning off our temporal injector next weekend, but...
That's right, yeah. What's cool about this is that all of the time zones, like we're distributed generally between North America, Europe, and Australia, and all of those time zones change at a different point. So,
because of course they do.
Yes. So Europe just changed as we're recording, and I think as of next time, Australia will also have changed.
And there are still rumors that we're going to stop doing it. I keep getting teased that we're going to stop doing it.
Well, I don't know if we talked about this on the show, but there's actually a law making its way through for the entire U.S. to stop doing the change and instead fix permanently on daylight savings time. So the time that we're on now.
Right.
So we'll see how it got through the Senate with unanimous consent. So people seem to be...
Wow, nothing gets through unanimously in the U.S. Senate. That's crazy.
I know.
That is a beloved law. Holy cow.
None of the important stuff gets through. But let's turn on daylight saving for the whole year. Yeah.
I have heard, some complaints about it saying, well... It's a good idea in principle, but you picked the wrong one because, it's just going to wind up being light at the wrong time. So it's possible that, that it should have been the other one.
But, I saw arguments on both sides of that. Yeah. And from my perspective, I don't know if there was a perfect right choice. Yeah. I just would like us to stop switching back and forth.
Well,
I'm totally on board for that.
Choice would be just to move it, by a half hour and stick on that.
Right. Split the difference. There you go.
No. Well, the United States can have one time zone.
That's right.
Well, China, I think, has one time zone. Isn't China all on one time zone, which must get crazy for dusks and dawns at some point, being such a broad country. That's bonkers. I think Canada is going to switch away from the 24-hour clock, though. We're going to say like 25 is more convenient. Yeah. And we're going to be out of sync quite a bit of the year with you guys.
Oh, no.
Seems like more fun.
We should introduce... Yeah, no. Let's introduce a metric clock.
Yeah. Or we'll switch over to three periods during the day. We do a whole hockey thing. We're just going to really embrace the stereotype and just do three periods, maybe with overtime, and that's for leap years. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll look after the bells then.
Excellent. Yeah, I read, when I was, you know, years ago in grad school, I read an essay about the 28-hour day, which the idea was supposed to be that if you put people in a cave or something, you know, and let them operate, but without the sort of like outside sun affecting
it. So like Vegas.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean like working from home? Okay.
Yeah, but like if you don't interact with the sun, so people sort of naturally will land on something like a 28-hour day. So the sun is kind of forcing it in a way that the argument was basically, you know, it'll basically shorten the week to 6 days, and you know, it was sort of worked out in some detail, like, you know, like how sometimes your lunch break would wind up being, you know, at the peak of night, but
but hey, whatever, we all live in caves, yeah. So who cares?
But it did seem sort of appealing.
All the creatives that I know who swear by night cereal. But they'll be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Night cereal? What's night cereal?
It's where after dinner you basically go and have a meal of your cereal, your Cocoa Pops or your Corn Flakes or granola, muesli, or other healthy crap. Give me the sugar-coated stuff any day.
Yeah, well,
especially,
that's for the morning.
Especially chocolate. No, I'll eat Cocoa Pops any time of the day.
Excellent. All right, so here we are. 1953 was the year that corresponds to the episode number 253. So far what we've been doing is basically just thinking about things that are tangentially related to 1953, not really in unison. But
I don't remember 1953 too well.
Yeah, somewhat before our times, I suppose. But so I think. Some of the things I think actually that Earl wanted to talk about, we covered in some aspects before, but I think they'll be interesting to revisit. Plus, we have some show and tell that will come across for the YouTube viewers. Maybe we can just get started. So, I don't know, Earl, did you want to start with your 1953 thoughts, since I've mentioned you already?
Well, when I was looking through the computer history timeline, it looked like 1953 was the year that the MIT Whirlwind, which was discussed previously, got core memory, magnetic core memory, which I've always found core memory to be fascinating. According to Wikipedia, it was actually the predominant form of RAM between 1955 and 1975. So that's a pretty good run, 20 years. I actually didn't know that it had stayed as the primary form of memory for that long.
It's the 1975 part of that surprises me.
Yeah.
1955, yes. Sure. But by 75, it's still predominant? That's crazy. Like 2 years before the Commodore 64, before the PET, before the Apple II. Like,
right.
That's bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
It seems really late for that to still be the main way memory is stored.
So I've always found it to be aesthetically beautiful. So magnetic core memory, if you haven't heard of it, you haven't seen it, it's little metal rings, or toroids, they call them, and they're arranged in a grid with wires crisscrossing through them in various directions.
It looks like chainmail kind of stuff. Whenever I look at it zoomed in things, it looks like something you'd wear in medieval times to thwart dragons.
Well, here I can do, for the YouTube viewers, Paul has a image up on the screen, and I can try and paint a word picture. So this is a bunch of metal rings, tiny in size, arranged in grids, rectangular grids, with copper wires going through them at various directions. And the little metal rings can be magnetized. And if they're magnetized in a particular way, then it's a one bit. If they're magnetized the other way, it's a zero bit. So the interesting thing is each one of the rings is a true physical representation of a single bit of computer memory. which I just find awesome. I think it's so awesome that you can actually look at them and see the individual bits. That's the thing that is just the the coolest thing for me.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that each bit is a little bit.
It's a very little bit.
What I always found funny about this is dealing with magnetism, and you've got a whole bunch of little intersections. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that we right away essentially went to magnetized, not magnetized, zeros, ones, versus positive, negative, nothing, going for the three states, which gives you so much more storage so quickly if you can read it. And I know there have been computers that try that, trinary computers, but they just, never taken off. But at this moment, this was the time where we could have done it. We could have just thought that way instead.
Huh. That's an interesting thought. Base 3 RAM.
I wonder if there would be, if it turned out that, the core memory lasted until, Apple designers got going. I wonder if you would have had, sort of weaving patterns and tapestries. Because it does seem like you could, if you wanted to, make art out of this beyond just function.
I think it is art. It looks like art to me. These look beautiful. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, as time went on, of course, like all computer things, it got smaller, more condensed. The amount of memory that you could store in a particular amount of square inches or feet or whatever increased. Another fascinating thing about core memory is because these little rings are magnetized, it's non-volatile. So when you turn the power off on the computer, the memory doesn't go away. You turn the power on later, you're right back where you started, unlike semiconductor RAM that, of course, loses its brain when you turn the power off. And one other thing I want to mention was that you'll still hear sometimes even semiconductor RAM called core, and that's just due to the legacy of magnetic core memory. Like if you see segmentation fault, core dumped, didn't really dump any magnetic core, but they still use the phrase, kind of in honor of the fact that this stuff was in use for so long. I also will we'll have a link in the show notes for episode 77 of another podcast called Advent of Computing, where the host for that podcast does a real deep dive into the background and the purpose and the history of magnetic core memory. So for those watching the TV show, you'll see I have a magnetic core memory here. Now you can just barely see the intersection of the wires, and those little darker areas are individual bits, little tiny rings.
Everything is so much smaller than I would have thought. I think of core memory as being big rings.
Well, when we get to the eBay section of the show, the auction that I'll talk about actually has a core memory with magnetic rings that are a lot bigger than what I was just showing. So maybe earlier, might have been earlier technology.
An odd thing about Project Whirlwind started in 1951. We talked a couple of episodes ago how, like, in 1951, the people working on it came up with the idea for magnetic memory and even filed the patent in 1951. But I found a bunch of sources that agree with this, that it's not till summer of 1953 that they actually install it in Whirlwind. What took 2 years? That seems like a slow development, right? They have the computer. The computer's functional. They've got the idea. They've patented it, and it's 2 full years before they actually install anything.
Well, it's probably because they couldn't remember it was Knit 1 Purl 1 or Knit 1 Purl 2. So.
Right. Yeah. Or you guys getting it working or whatever. But it's interesting that it took 2 full years to do that.
Or they had to train the mice to actually run the little looms to weave it all.
Yeah, when I was looking through, through the 1950s area myself too, there is a lot of stuff that it's hard to assign a year to it. Do you say like this is when the Whirlwind one started, but this is when we got the thing that we talked about? Do we talk about, there's a lot of things that just spanned a couple of years. This is when the machine was introduced. This is when it was first installed in a customer location.
But crazy time.
It's dangerous thing first.
It's pretty interesting, but okay. Let's see. Well, Carrington, did you have a 1950s thought?
No, the next year is going to be an interesting one, and the years previous to this are an interesting one. This, I find, a very boring year in computers. It's nice that they installed the RAM in the Whirlwind, but like, what have you done for me lately? I watched that video.
Call
somebody
them up
linked.
And complain.
Somebody linked a video about the thinking machine that from the movie from 1961, and I watched that. That was fascinating.
Yeah,
and I guess it's appropriate because it deals with the IBM 701. Which is IBM's first computer, I think, right? And that's from this year.
Yep.
So that's exciting. But the movie in question, The Thinking Machine, that's from 1961. So we could talk about it, I guess, again when we get there. And there's a really interesting part of showing people playing chess with this computer. And so that was fascinating. It's like, checkers even. It wasn't even chess. They're playing checkers. They've taught this computer to play checkers. How exciting. And there's an actor talking to... mathematician or scientist or whatever. And the actor I know of as the dad in the Ellery Queen TV show. That guy. That's Ellery Queen's dad from the Ellery Queen TV show. So he's the police detective, but his son helps him solve the murder mysteries. So this guy can't even solve crimes on his own. How's he going to understand computer checkers?
Yeah. It's pretty interesting watching these videos, you know, from then. But the IBM 701 was the thing I was gonna kind of latch onto as a 1953 related thing, and so the Thinking Machine documentary is, you know, it is sort of looking back in retrospect at some things that involved mostly it's about artificial intelligence, machine learning, that kind of thing, kind of introducing it to the public. So it's only kind of related to the 701. The connection to the 701 was that they have a little clip of somebody playing checkers against the IBM 701. And that's actually the person, I think the person, I'm not sure if it's the person playing it, or I think it's the person that's standing over it is the one who wrote the checkers program.
Right.
And it,
and then, and when it wins, he like runs away to the printer all proud, like, oh, my computer just trounced this guy, which is pretty funny. Uh-huh. And it shows the printer earlier. So just a little after this, he's going to get all excited and run to the printer and celebrate. Uh-huh. And when he runs up to the printer is massive.
Yeah.
It's so much larger than you would think when you see, he's about to run to the printer.
Yeah.
Look, he became a little tiny man. He's a little tiny man. There's a giant printer. It says, you lose. Thanks for the game. He programmed a snarky computer. I love it.
Yeah. But there is also something a little bit funny about the, you know, this sort of image of a, you know, whatever, it's got to be millions of dollars computer being used to play a checkers game. But, and this was there. So prior to this, in 1956, there was a, this is actually not this exact thing. This is probably sort of a recreation of a sort, but it was shown on television, this, you know, self-proclaimed checkers master up against this big computer. It turned out, I think the self-proclaimed part was a kind of a analysis in retrospect of how good this guy actually was. The computer won, but it turned out that it may not have been as big of a feat as it initially sounded.
I'm sure the computer gave a snarky comment to that result then.
Yeah. IBM 701, not to be confused with the IBM ThinkPad 701. But
they're almost the same size.
But it claims that it is the first commercial scientific computer. Or IBM's first commercial scientific computer. I mean,
everything from the
down.
50s is the first something.
Yeah.
It's going to be commercial scientific computer.
Yeah.
Yes. The first computer to call itself the first computer since the first one was actually first.
Right. So I think what happened is that in 1952 it was announced, and I think IBM actually took delivery of one of their own in their own property, IBM World Headquarters in 1952, but the first one that kind of went out to the public was 1953. There were 19 of them. So here are all, you know, on the Wikipedia page, here are all 19 IBM 701s. That's all there were.
Well, I did see something that estimated 1953, the year we're dealing with now, is the year they estimate that worldwide computers hit 100. There were 100 computers at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really all we ever needed. I'm surprised it ever got more.
Which all puts paid to the original IBM declaration that the whole world would only ever need, what, 5 or 7 mainframe computers?
Yeah. Yeah, I think Ray Watson said that at some point.
Yeah.
Didn't you say that video was from MIT?
Yeah, I think it's I think MIT made it available. not very available because it's unlisted, but at any rate.
Yeah. I'm just trying to figure out how much core memory did they need to upload that video, that move, that film to YouTube back then.
I'm sure it took many, many months to, you know, toggle the switches to get this video up.
That's right.
But it's really, it really looks nice, though. I mean, it's a very good copy. And I was completely unable to find any record of the 1956 TV spot. I think that probably was just not captured. So
yeah, it's a pristine print. I do wish it had been filmed in color, though. I would have liked to have seen these computers in color. But
yeah,
it is what it is.
Maybe this was part of the world that was still black and white.
It could be.
That's right. So IBM has some stuff on the IBM 701 in their own history, you know, IBM.com history pages. And if you look, move around, you know, there's a sort of index of, like, you can get the chronology and list of the components and, you know, specifications about, like, how many digits per second the punched card output is and that kind of stuff. If you want to see video of it, you can go to Bytes and Sites, where they have video segments divided into high bandwidth and low bandwidth real player files.
Oh, goodness.
So it turns out they are, you know, 7 seconds long and tiny. So it is actually not very interesting video. But I thought it was kind of funny that in IBM's history page, they still have, you know, real player video.
It's a history page.
It is. Another thing, too, is that the IBM 701 had an electrostatic storage unit. We were talking about that, too, when we were talking about the Whirlwind. The CRT-based memory storage.
So fascinating.
Yeah. So they're called Williams tubes. I did not know they were called
Williams tubes. Oh, I did not know that. Williams okay, tubes. Cool.
So if you want to look this
up. As opposed to Jeffries.
Yes, the Jeffries tube.
Oh, you were prepared. Okay.
Is the name for the little corridors in all I think Starfleet ships in Star Trek, named after the set constructor designer. So I think that
I didn't know that's where they got their name. Interesting. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you're in this sort of behind the scenes Star Trek world, that's, you will have heard of Jeffries tubes, and Williams tubes are not those. But yes, it's funny though, when I saw Williams tubes, that is also the first thing that kind of leapt to my mind. It just sounds like a Jeffries tube. Anyway, I think
and
that
the
was
other
about
funny thing is that you were showing that on Memory Alpha.
Yep.
So it's a memory thing.
That's true. It is. Memory Alpha is the kind of like a central repository of knowledge for Star Trek related things. So. And I am not steeped enough in this to know exactly what all the references are. I'm sure that has some in-world reference as well. But
yeah, I enjoy watching my Star Trek too much to get all anal about it like some people do. But
some people do enjoy that part of it, I think.
Mm.
Anyway, yeah, I think that was the main thing I just wanted to point out of my 1953 thing. Oh, yeah. Also, another thing that I had written down and I hadn't looked up at all is that this drive manufacturer whose name is represented by the four letters T, E, A, and C.
You coward. Say it.
Well, I was curious. So I think Carrington and I were on this recording when we talked about that last time. But how would if you weren't here, how would you say the name of that?
I've always said TIAC.
Okay.
TIAC.
Okay, yeah. See, when I saw it, in my head, I always said teak, and apparently that was
no, that'd have
quite
a K
unusual.
On the end if it was teak.
So
I think TIAC was the way people said it.
Yeah, quite possible. Yeah.
Sounds Jeff.
Yeah.
If you were Roman, it'd be teak, because they used the hard C.
That's true. It would be like, what would that be, T100? okay. Yeah, Will does suggest that if you call their the support line, they will pronounce it for you. The TIAC people or TEAC people or TEAC people.
Well, I had Abby Books do that for me, so I guess we do the same thing for these people.
Yeah. Okay, so Tony wrote a couple of things. Actually, it's possible that all of the feedback I'm going to mention in the feedback section is from Tony. Thank you, Tony. the first thing is he wrote to point out the Exploring the Amiga series on the Digital Cat blog. And basically just sort of pointing out the existence of it. It's modern. It's a person in the modern day looking to do some assembly language programming on the Amiga, and sort of talks through what you need to install to do it on a Linux platform. And this is in 8 parts, by the way, but it's kind of hidden at the end. But there is a couple of resources that you can use. Tony was a little bit surprised that there weren't any books referenced that actually told you like how the operating system works or how the architecture works or whatever. A lot of it is just about programming the 68,000 basically. But hidden in the Amiga OS developer docs, there is a little bit of stuff that I think should sort of help if you wanted to make an application. But so I know Quinn was talking about wanting to try to do something like this, and I'm not sure that I have ever really felt very compelled to try to learn 68,000 programming. That just it feels like that's too complicated for humans. have any of you actually done that and worked with the 68,000 at the assembly level?
No.
Not even when I did a Mac stuff. No.
Yeah, I mean, I have seen it when I hit the interrupt button on the side of the SE or whatever, and
right.
I know how to make it say like start again at address 0 or whatever it is you're supposed to do, but I mean that's like the extent of everything I've ever done with it. But it just seems like it's just too much. It seems like it's just too many instructions, too hard to keep track of. I'd much rather work in a higher level language. But if you are not like me, then you might find this interesting. Another article that Tony pointed out is a brief tour of the PDP-11. And I think actually maybe I'll some of the stuff that I'll talk about later in the topics will relate to this a bit. It's from Pi Day, so quite recently. And so if you wanted to familiarize yourself with the PDP-11 and its history, it played a big role in the formation of Unix and C and so forth. So it's on Ars Technica. Did any of you read this?
No, I didn't really follow any Pi Day links or anything, really, or this in particular.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the 22nd of July for Pi Approximation Day. But,
yeah, nice. Okay, and then I think the last thing I will mention, the last thing that Tony sent is it's a review of the top 20 Commodore 64 games from 2011 to 2021. And the thing that's largely interesting about this is the fact that there are enough that there could be a top 20. I mean, like, these are all games that are produced in the modern day between 2011 and 2021. And this is sort of in honor of the 40th anniversary of the Commodore 64 itself. But so congratulations to all those who are still writing programs for the Commodore 64.
It seems like it's actually accelerating. I see more and more news story.
So is the bottom 20 the same list?
No. There's a whole big pile of honorable mentions too.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I just love it that all of our old machines are still getting the love that they deserve.
Mm-hmm. Earlier you were saying you think it's accelerating in sort of volume.
It seems like it is. Yeah. I mean, part of it could be the continual fine-tuning of the development tools and the information on techniques, tricks to program for the platform. And not just for the Commodore 64, but for all the 8-bits.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the interesting thing is that a lot of the cool tricks that they use today, you could have used back in the day if you'd known about them, if the state of the art had advanced to that point.
Right.
But some amazing stuff coming out. And the other thing is that I find really cool are the physical releases. So they will actually not just upload a game that you can download and play, but actually sell it with a box and a manual and a disc and all that kind of thing. Imagine getting one of those shrink wrapped.
Or produce it on a cart.
Yeah.
Or yes. Yeah, that's true too. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, as you're saying, the tricks that they're using, or techniques might be better, were available then, but it's also the adjunct tools that we have available to assist in this. So, getting the graphics right and building it all, we can push a lot of this off to systems tools running on our modern hardware, where it would have had to have been beautifully hand-coded back in the day, or done on an assembler on the actual hardware. It's not taking anything away from what's being done today, but it's, we have different tools available, but it's all so beautiful. I just love it.
Yeah, that speed of the sort of speed of iterative development, I think I'm sure would make a big difference, because if you can just like try something and see how it looks, and then try something else and see how it looks, that's so much different from like really saying, is this worth trying? Because I'm going to have to wait 2 hours to assemble this.
Yeah. And also, once someone has built the tools, they're available. The high-grade programmers are developing the games and the tools, and then you've got the B-grade programmers like me who then take the tools and run with it, rather than having to spend all that time. There's quite a few things that even on my Apple that I don't truly understand, but I know enough to use the tools of today to make interesting bits and pieces. But I could sit and watch these top 10, top 20 type things for all the different machines anytime, all the time.
Yeah, it's I knew the video existed. I hadn't actually sort of scrubbed through it, now it's sort of playing in the background as we're talking. But they are quite impressive. Okay, let's see. I think that. Oh yeah, and I guess the other link that I had put in the show notes was just the one of probably many articles that's just mentioning that the at the beginning of the year the Commodore 64 turned 40. I think we may not have acknowledged that. I'm not sure if we did, but that's that's pretty impressive. 1982. It seems like the longer we do this podcast, the later the years are that are 40 years ago.
Right. It's funny how it works that way.
Yeah, the 1980s feel like they're only 20 years ago.
Yeah. All right. I think that'll do for the official feedback that is not stolen for topics. And now we can go to the regular items of interest and news. Carrington has the first of these.
I do. Okay, so first I'm going to recommend that if you are the sort of person who reads and subscribes to blogs, you should read and subscribe to a new one called Engineers Need Art, and it's by John Calhoun. Now, if the name seems familiar, if you're an old Mac gamer, you'll know that's the person who came up with the game Glider and things like Stella Obscura and Perina and a bunch of things, did games for Cassidy and Green, and then went on to be a Macintosh developer. And so he's got a new blog out, launched November of last year, and the reason you might want to follow this is he's doing cool projects, the latest of which is this thing called System 6. He says a small desk accessory sort of thing. It's written in Python, runs on a Raspberry Pi, but he put it in this crazy beautiful case. Looks like a Mac Plus, Mac SE, carved, so a little tiny thin thing. We discussed once a prototype or something else that was in this shape.
Yeah.
Paul, do you remember? It was something like this. Exactly like this.
I think it was sort of like an art designer who had sort of made like the front. It was sort of the front of this. So it actually had a little bit of a foot, but it had like laptop components in it, so it was actually super thin.
Yeah. Like this. So imagine like buildings where it's like been torn down, but the front still exists.
Yeah.
It's one of those sorts of things, but as a Mac Plus.
A facade.
But this is a Raspberry Pi desk accessory. So the idea,
Mac facade.
Mac facade, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it displays, there's a picture here somewhere. Oh, see System 6. I'll show you some more examples for people watching online. It displays a screen. Now, it's an e-ink display, so it's not interactive. It just changes itself once a day. And the point is, it's a desk calendar. So it says, like, a scrapbook, like, what you've got going on that day. It's got your calendar events. It's got a little thing that shows the phase of the moon. And then in the background, it shows a bunch of icons, and the icons can change every day, too. In the current screenshot we're showing, it shows the trash all fattened out, like it needs to be emptied. And if that was how it always displayed, it would trigger me like crazy because I'd want to be emptying it. But it turns out that's a setting. You can pick which days of the week you want the trash to appear full. He programmed it so on Mondays it appears full because that's the day he's supposed to take the trash out in real life. So, like, what a delightful, delightful little project. Now, this isn't a thing you can buy, but I'm hoping pressure gets put on so at least the code or something is released. He released Glider as freeware. Maybe he'll do the same thing. I think this is delightful. I would absolutely love to have something like this on a desk or bedside or whatever that looks like a really skinny Mac Plus that displays just an e-ink image of the things for the day that you can set what you'd like on there. I'd love this thing. Absolutely love it. So it's on the Engineers Need Art, which is engineersneedart.com. I love it. I love the project. I want this very badly, and I will follow this blog going forward because maybe this thing will become available. So.
Hmm. Yeah, I've wondered a little bit about e-ink. I don't think I've ever had an e-ink device. You know, I've seen Kindles and Nooks and stuff, but
yeah, I have them. I don't like the little flash when it has to change, but something that's like literally just displaying for the day and say okay, because once you set it, you can just say that's it. It's set. It takes very little power to keep it up. It's perfect for this sort of thing, a change once a day display.
Yeah.
And being that it's supposed to look like a little black and white, you know, 5.5-inch Mac display or 9.5-inch Mac display, it's perfect because that's the look of e-ink. E-ink looks like old Mac displays. He uses the same dithering you'd see in, who was it that did HyperCard? Atkinson?
If I had to guess, that would be the name that I would guess, yes.
Yes, me too. So I'm guessing Atkinson. So Atkinson dithering is what's used for the moon phase, if you want that display. This project's delightful. It absolutely delights me. So, and I have Raspberry Pis. I can get an e-ink display. I could make this, I think. Oh, yeah, Jeremy in the chat. It's Bill Atkinson. Thank you, Jeremy. Yeah. I thought we were close, if not right.
Yeah.
So points for us. 5 points for Gryffindor.
Yeah, I think that is it. If there is ever going to be RCR merch, that maybe could be the slogan. Close, if not right.
And we will slightly misspell it.
Yeah. Okay. The next thing is Earl's.
There's a new YouTube video on the Adrian's Digital Basement YouTube channel about a Southwest Technical Products, I don't know if the C stands for corporation, but SWTPC 6800 system that Adrian rescued from e-waste. The video is good. It talks about the computer and the background of the computer, that sort of thing. And also, if you go to the video, you'll find a link in the description of the video for Mike Douglas, his YouTube channel, which goes into a lot more detail on this particular computer. The thing that I found fascinating about all of this, though, was that a SWTPC system from 1975 was going to be e-wasted. And I just wanted to point that out because I wonder how many classic computers. I remember looking at ads for this particular computer in magazines in the 70s and thinking it looks cool and, you know, it looks like it has a lot of neat functionality and that kind of thing, drooling about it but knowing I couldn't afford anything like this. And it's also one of a handful of iconic kit computers from this pre-1977 era with the PET and the Apple II and the TRS-80. I can't imagine that something like this could have been e-wasted. Like right now, all of these pieces that if you're watching the YouTube, you're seeing we're playing a little bit of the video here. All of these pieces right now could be being melted down for parts, and that just kills me. It just makes me wonder how much classic stuff like this is actually making its way to recyclers. And that's the main reason I wanted to point it out. He said, yeah, I rescued this from e-waste, and just a little shudder went down my spine. Like, no, don't do that.
But I can also sort of sympathize a bit with the people who feel like, I don't want to think about what this is. It is in my way. It is heavy. You know, I want to clean this out. And it's hard to say no. You know, you must keep this thing that is bothering you.
Well, in your way. It looks like, I mean, I like the look of it. It's, you know, one of the big square monster computers from that era. Imagine something the size of an Altair or an IMSI and probably equally heavy. And you might look at it if you weren't aware of old computing and go, this just looks like an old piece of junk or an old piece of test equipment or something like that. I'm just going to take it to e-waste. That could happen. But how exactly does that happen? How does it get passed down from one person to another? What, stuck in a storage unit or somehow makes its way to somebody who has no clue what it is? That's close to inconceivable to me. I guess not quite, because this was about to go down the pipeline.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess some of the protection from that could come from people being aware that this could be worth a lot, you know? I mean, like if they...
Right.
But people do have to care about that.
Something like this working at Knott, I think, would be still in the hundreds of dollars, if not more than that. And so definitely worth rescuing from the shredder.
If you can find the right person to show it to, though. I mean, if you show it to the you know, the guy at Best Buy and say, you know, what is this? What can you give me for this?
Sure.
You may not get the result you're hoping for. But. All right, let's see. The next thing is Michael's.
Okay, so this came up on the New Zealand Retro Computing Facebook group, and it's just a reminder of how things have changed. So this one here is for a technical career at Burroughs Limited in Auckland, New Zealand. And I just love the way it starts. Young men aged 18 to 22 with above average learning ability required to commence training in this exciting and rapidly expanding field. So I suppose, you know, this is from February 1974, but that kind of job ad persisted well into the 80s. I remember going through the Tuesday computer job supplement, IT supplement, in the one of the national papers here. And, you know, you always kept an eye on the Tuesday for the IT Australian just to see what jobs were going, and as well as the articles and whatnot. But it was pretty much like this. But
you
know, makes me wonder sort of like, you know, how things have changed or how things haven't changed into today. Like they wouldn't say, you know, young men aged 18 to 22, because no, you're excluding those of the female persuasion. You're being ageist, looking for that particular group. You know, you're specifying a learning ability.
Yeah, so things have changed a lot. They just don't put that in the ad anymore.
That's
but
right.
Don't change the hiring practices.
Yeah. So that's what I was saying. So how much haven't things changed? So it's just the verbiage that has changed. Some of the preconceived ideas of who does what kind of job is for the boys, what kind of job's for the girls. And sadly, I'd have to say that it hasn't moved along enough. I just thought it was interesting just to sort of see a snapshot of a job ad from back in 1974. Pity it wasn't for another 20 years earlier, but I wasn't quite so fortunate to trip across something that old. But then down below, you see a trainee project manager, $4,700 per annum.
Yeah.
It's like, oh gosh, that's now kind of like monthly. That's per month.
Yeah.
Or fortnight, even. Fortnight would be more likely. But though I think some project managers are chronically overpaid.
So this would be, you know, sort of in the time period when core memory was still the dominant type of storage.
Why wouldn't they want a young lady aged 18 to 22 with above average domestic sewing knitting skills to repair the core memory that's still being used?
I think there were, you know, like stuff like that. I'm sure we've looked at old NASA footage and stuff where they were putting together the memory.
Yes, yeah. The Apollo. There's some great YouTube videos of the computing hardware and everything going into the Apollo program, and they show basically ladies at effectively their looms, and they're weaving the core memory and pre-setting. So effectively, they're making the day's equivalent of the ROM. It was core memory that couldn't be changed. You could read the core, but you couldn't write to it. So that was effectively the firmware that was being used, and just the speed of what they were doing, and just the as Erla said, the beauty of core memory. It's an art, it's a craft, it's beautiful, but we still go and slot people into different types of jobs. That's a job for a male, that's a job for a female.
It is interesting that it does feel surprising to read. I mean, like, I'm not actually surprised that it was published in 1974, but I mean, it still feels surprising when you read that text that specifies these seemingly unrelated characteristics.
Yep.
It's like,
it's crazy.
How is this relevant?
Anyway, so if you're interested in this job, the contact details are there, and the phone number with so few digits in it.
Excellent. You're saying so few digits, and it just reminded me tangentially of the fact that I got a Twitter account like pretty close to the beginning of the platform in like 2007 or something like that, and I forget it. My user number is in the millions or something like that, 7 million, something like that. And then I made another one not too long ago. I think I may even mention this here, but I mean, my user number on that is like, I'm not even sure. It's got a lot
numbers
of commas and triplets of numbers in it. But essentially, it boils down to, I think if you do the math, there's based on that user number I got, there's something like 16 million Twitter accounts per living human.
Oh my goodness.
So I think I've got four.
Yeah, I think this is
obviously three that I'm not at, so like we're planned to use but never got around to. Uh-huh. But letting the side down. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I discovered this when based on the Twitter terms of service, you have to be 13 years old in order to use the platform. And so when my Twitter account turned 13, I made a Twitter account for it. So that was the development in user IDs over 13 years. But okay, let's see. So my thing actually is a stolen feedback, which is something that Tony wrote to tell us about. But it's pretty interesting. It's a website called Multitions, and what it is essentially a site devoted to multics. Multiplexed information and computing service, multi-user time-sharing system. So I don't know to what extent people know about multics. Probably we've all heard of it at some point. It's sort of at the broader level, it is the thing that kind of predated and inspired in some sense Unix. And Unix is in fact a joke name. Unix is... It's one of whatever multics is several of, right? So, so it's pretty interesting actually, kind of going through this. They've got some history and myths about. Most of the myths are multics failed and they are busted in various ways because the multics didn't fail. It succeeded. It just had different goals than what you're talking about or whatever. But it also talks a fair bit about the relationship with Unix. But it's kind of a neat large project that collects all this stuff together. So if you had any interest in this, the history of it is essentially, I think the MIT had some sort of time sharing system that they put together. It was the compatible time sharing system, CTSS, and that's the thing that predated multics, but the idea was essentially that computer time is expensive and you want to be able to use all of it, so you want to be able to have multiple people scheduling jobs and things like that during it. Multics, I think, was a development of the compatible time-sharing system idea jointly funded by several, I think it was Bell Labs and MIT and someone else. And there was also a funny little, you know, this like the Unix joke on Multics was also, you know, that kind of joke was also played with the compatible time sharing system, where the little group at MIT who didn't like some of the aspects of the direction that the compatible time sharing system was going made their own called the incompatible time sharing system. And I think we had talked about that actually before, because it's at some point 2 years ago or something like that, it became possible to emulate it on SimH or something. So you could run the incompatible time sharing system. In that same email, Tony recommended a book called A Quarter Century of Unix by Peter Salas. I was able to, with not very much searching, find an illegitimate copy of it on the web in PDF form, but it, you know, you can purchase it. It's an Addison Wesley history, and it's not too long, 278 pages in the PDF. So if you are interested in the history of Unix and how it relates to Multics and that kind of thing, it's in here. The little I don't know what you call it, epigraph on the book is this little chunk of the code, lines 2240 to 2243. I think we also talked about this when the Unix code went up on GitHub or something like that. But it's a little segment which I think has to do with context switching or something like that. But the comment above it says, "You are not expected to understand this," and then it has a little terse bunch of code, and it's probably the best part of that whole source code. But anyway, that's it. Anyone wanted to comment on any of that?
Well, a question: when did that book come out?
It is 1994, so not super old, but not super recent either.
Well, but it goes back a quarter century.
Yeah.
So the book is historical in its own right.
True.
And it can get you some of the early history of the Unix operating system. So
yeah,
seems like it would be an interesting read.
Yeah, I am kind of hoping that I will have time to look through this more, you know, slowly. I kind of skimmed it and read the forewords and stuff like that, but I'm trying to get to the content so I can display it here. But it does have a lot of stuff about sort of like how everybody interacted and, you know, what happened at Bell, what role the PDP-11 played and that sort of thing.
So, I will second the notion that it's very easy to find this online as a PDF, judging by the latest thing in my downloads folder. So yes.
Yeah.
What a coincidence. Look, very easy to find.
Yep.
Thank you for the tip.
All right. I think I'll leave it there. And we will now go on to an Easter egg that has been making the rounds.
Oh, that would be me. Yep. I look like an Easter egg. It must be me. So an Easter egg has been found in Windows 1.0. Previously, the earliest Easter eggs were thought to be in Windows 3, but somebody has found one in Windows 1. Earlier and earlier Easter eggs keep getting found. This is pretty cool. So somebody named Lucas Brooks discovered an Easter egg. It is simply the names of a bunch of the creators, including, you'll see it here somewhere, Gabe Newell, a name people will probably know. These names were encoded. They were both encoded themselves and then hidden inside the bitmap for a smiley face. So that's where this was. And speculation is running hot and heavy that there is probably some secret key combination or secret code you can enter that will make this display in Windows, like to actually bring this up, because it's quite hidden. But nobody's found that yet. But names were found. So it's the earliest Windows Easter egg now, right in 1.0. And it's neat that it was both encoded and then hidden inside a little smiley face icon, or bitmap rather. So kind of neat. So just a list of names, and people are now frantically looking for something that would call upon this code and make it displayed so people find out how it was supposed to be revealed when you're actually running Windows 1. But who would run Windows 1? I don't know. Maybe just to look at it.
It'd be the most interesting part of running Windows 1, because I've got an original box set of Windows 1, and it's underwhelming.
I don't actually quite understand the technical aspect of how it is hidden in the smiley face. Is it in place of the smiley face, or do you somehow get a slightly weird looking smiley face because somehow buried in it are these names?
Well, And see, that's the thing. I was looking, like, how does one encode this? So I tried to look both at TechSpot and in, this was unveiled. I first saw it on Twitter, a bunch of people talking about it, and everyone simply says it's encoded inside the bitmap. There's a bitmap for a smiley face, and it's encoded in that. So I'm assuming it's extra parts of the bitmap. Yeah. The bitmap is so much is needed, and then there's a bunch of extra at the end or something like that.
Yeah.
That's what I'm assuming is done, but I can't find any technical details at all, except a couple of screenshots. So that's why I picked the TechSpot one, because at least it shows a screenshot of somebody displaying it. So.
Yeah.
And how do you find something like this?
You're going to have a lot of time on your hands, man.
Yeah, right. No kidding.
Probably by noticing, looking at a bunch of bitmaps and say, hey, why is this one
step one,
larger
don't have a lot
than the rest? Like, why is this one 6 bytes bigger or whatever? And say, what is this extra part for? Then say, hey, this can actually be decoded into a list of names. That's what I'm assuming happened.
Yeah, I would think, actually, I mean, a list of names, text does take not a lot of space, but I mean, when we're talking about a 16 by 16 icon or something like that, I mean, like, it's going to look like a lot of data.
Yep. Yeah. To get an additional 8 people's names, first and second name, is a lot of data compared to your, like you say, compared to a, but we don't know that this is an icon though.
Yeah.
It's referred to as it's a smiley face bitmap. Mm-hmm. So it could have been an entire screen thing. It could be something where the extra data wouldn't necessarily jump out.
Yeah.
If it was an icon, if it was a 16 by 16 icon or 8 by 8 icon or whatever, then yeah, certainly we're tripling the size of what it should be. So.
I know on the Apple II, they have a very elegant set of colors available in the high res mode. You have purple and green and red and blue, black and black and white and white. And I'm wondering, like, you could actually do something like hide things in two different kinds of white,
two different blacks.
Yeah. Black probably is better. White, I think you might be able to tell the difference, but it's tricky because you only get one, you know, your choice can only be made once every 7 pixels. But anyway, I could imagine that would be one way to hide something in a bitmap, is to actually use colors that are close or non-distinct.
Like a early or primitive version of steganography.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's the word that's been on the tip of my brain since we first started talking about this. Thinking, I wish it would come back. Like, what is that thing? Steganography, yes.
Yeah, I kept ending up as Stegosaurus.
Yeah, it was just
close enough.
Yeah.
Somebody hit a dinosaur inside this bitmap.
Yep.
Stegosaurus, I guess that's still called Stegosaurus. Didn't Brontosaurus get renamed?
Brontosaurus, I think, became Albertosaurus now, I think, something like that. Brontosaurus isn't a real thing, except on Flintstones.
Yeah.
In a Bronto burger.
Mm. Exactly.
Good. Who's got the next thing? Oh, yes, Michael has the next thing.
Yes, the obligatory one. Let's see.
We don't call you that when you're on the show.
Yeah.
Where are we? Tab.
I think they stopped making Tab Cola. And, you know, that's one of those things that's, you know, from the 70s and 80s that I just never, I could never really get behind. It tasted terrible.
Tab?
Yeah.
Okay, so where did that come from? Just because Michael was talking about tabs?
Yeah, because I was just talking about sharing tabs. Yeah.
And if you give Paul too long, these are the tangents Paul, he goes on.
Yeah,
holy moly, who thinks of Tab Cola?
Yeah.
It's been like, has this, by the early 80s, I think that was gone, right?
No, well, I think
forever since then.
I thought I actually read a story like within the last year that they were finally discontinuing it.
Oh, Tab Energy came out in 2006. I was very wrong. Tab Extra in 1994. Of course, it was Extra in the 90s. Yeah.
I shouldn't leave tangents open for Paul to fall down, but
excellent.
Yeah, this is the private retro computer museum in Mariupol in the Ukraine.
Oh, I heard about this.
Yeah, so, you know, people sort of say, well, you know, how does this war affect me? Well, the war affects people in more important ways than this, but this shows how even tangentially everyone is affected. And, the Russian military have advertently, on purpose, increased the value of working retro computer pieces and game pieces by destroying a private museum in Mariupol, in their current fracas in the Ukraine. So there are more important things happening. There are sadder things happening, but this basically just brings it home to that we can all be affected in some way. And you know, it's sad that the years of work of someone has been destroyed. Things get destroyed by flood, fire, and now you can add cruise missiles to the list, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. It really did look pretty impressive. I mean, like I've seen some of the photos from the collection, I think that there was a really like nice pong machine or something at the top of the picture, and it's I can appreciate the effort that went into getting one of everything like that.
And it's not the sort of thing that you can just grab and run with, and there's obviously far more important things to grab and get the F out of the area than worrying about your collection of retro games and retro computers. But it's a site that I was aware of before its current flash into infamy, and it's something that we'll now no longer be able to see apart from things that have been saved, which brings me to my tangent, is that the Internet Archive has embarked on a project to save Ukrainian hosted sites and information and things. So thanks to the good work at the archive, at least there'll be digital things saved for the future. And it's sad when you see things like this happen, but there are sadder things to be worried about. But I just thought that should just bring this up.
Yeah.
Sadly.
It does make my next contribution not seem quite up to it. But yeah, anyway, no, it definitely is worth mentioning that and being aware of that. It is, you know, irreversible. So, okay, let's see. I think I have another thing. I guess I am the last one to have another thing. I will mention this sort of quickly. This is Blake's, but Blake couldn't be here. So,
so you lose, Blake.
Yeah. So I will talk about it. This is, I don't know if he would have brought this up, but he did write, a thing about this, and this is actually relatively a long time ago, November 2008. And so on the Byteseller, there's an article. It's sort of talking about Miniscribe and the fact that this was basically the first hard disk that Blake ever owned. And so I was sort of talking about this and talking about how he was kind of wondering about how, like, what was Miniscribe up to these days, you know, like, because he remembered this sort of fondly. And part of the story was, so he had convinced his mother to order this Miniscribe hard drive as a Christmas present for himself, and it arrived in early December, and had been sort of sitting under the tree for a long time. And Blake was sort of like chatting with somebody online and speculated that, you know, he could just open it and put a brick in there, and take the hard drive out and install stuff on, not have to wait for Christmas. You know, nobody would know because it'd be still, you know, wrapped under the tree and heavy. So he did this. He said, less than an hour later, I was installing X3 Pro on my capacious storage device. What prompted this was actually there was a video pretty recently, March 25th. It was posted on Tech Time Traveler, and it's called the one of the biggest frauds in tech history, the Miniscribe brick fiasco. Did you guys know about this before?
I did not. I only heard it when Blake brought this up and you guys were talking about it, the whole shipping a brick thing. Which is something you got to say slowly.
Yeah.
Nope, I had never heard about this.
Yeah, so this video is sort of like an investigative report or whatever. It's 20 minutes long, 22 minutes long, basically. And kind of goes through a lot of details about the computer industry and, like, the place of hard drives in it. And and a lot of the sort of business aspects of it. But the kind of the main point of this was essentially this company Miniscribe was I think it was taken over or you know sold to somebody who or somebody was brought in at least to try to like keep the company afloat and make it prosper. And what ended up happening was you know through all of this that at a certain point they were doing badly enough on money because they were you know falsifying records or whatever, and so like they were claiming to be doing better than they actually were, and that was causing trouble, as you might expect. But so at a certain point, they had this idea that they needed to sell a bunch of hard drives, but they didn't really have the money to make them. So what they ended up doing is they got a bunch of bricks. The company bought an actual bunch of bricks and put a bunch of bricks in the boxes, and then they shipped the boxes. And the plan was that they would then you know, they would use that capital to build the things that they needed to build. And then they would recall all of those serial numbers and replace them with actual hard drives.
wow.
And yeah, so, and this actually did happen. So, I think nobody, I from what I understand, I'm not aware of anybody who's actually gotten a box with a brick in it. I think they did actually manage to like sort of get them all taken care of before any stores or customers got them. Like I did search to see if I could find on eBay, you know, a brick in a box.
Like a sealed one. And people are like, I don't know. Feels like maybe the right weight. Get yourself a brick.
Yeah.
It's crazy that they could think, I mean, I guess they did get away with it, but it's crazy that you could, that you don't get ratted out. Like some employees are not going to say, well, you're literally shipping bricks inside boxes to people. Like, how do you think you get away with this?
Yeah.
How did they get away with this? It's crazy. It's crazy that that would work.
It sort of corresponded to, like, they did this, but then they also downsized and fired a bunch of people who were there at that point, you know, ready to dish the dirt.
They said, hit the bricks. Yeah, I'm here all week, folks.
Yep.
That one was for Quinn.
I'm sure she appreciates it. Yeah, so astoundingly, Miniscribe embarked on a round of layoffs just before the Christmas shutdown, including several of the employees that were involved in the packaging and shipping of masonry. So these people immediately called the Denver area newspapers. The Blake's end to his blog post about this says, so there it is. I snuck down to swap a brick for the real goods when there was a half-decent chance that the Miniscribe's execs had already done me that favor.
Imagine the story, though, if he went down to do this and he opened up and there's already a brick in there. He's like, did I already do this and I've had a stroke? Is my mom messing with me? Did she know I was going to do this? And now she wants to know if I'm going to say anything? Like, imagine what would have gone through little Blake's mind if there was already a brick in that box.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
And I think that was it, actually, for the items of interest and news. So,
time for gifts or commercials.
But why can't we have both?
Yes, and so, right, exactly. As Carrington said, now a word from our sponsor.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, I've now made it through all of the tabs that I opened.
And drank all the tabs that weren't.
Excellent.
Next time I'll try to have a tab cooler.
Am I wrong? Did they not just recently stop something? Maybe I imagined that. But I thought
could be.
I thought that there was some recent end to the production of or purchasability of tab.
Oh, it was
not
so,
enough people are roller skating anymore. Yeah, so they said
so horrific. I couldn't get near one, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there was actually a court order that the tab couldn't be within like 100 feet of me.
Yeah.
Drink it by court order. Drink it because the judge said you had to. I don't have a memory of drinking tab cola. I think I wouldn't have liked it.
Yeah.
So I suspect if I did have it, I was like, no, I don't want to drink that. But I don't know if I ever actually tasted it.
I think I tasted it, you know, twice. Probably is about
it. See, that can't be really what it was like.
Yeah.
I've watched a couple of movies like that where I'll think, that movie must be better than I remember it. And I'll watch it, like, nope, why did I just believe me? This is terrible.
Yeah.
I just could never get over, whenever I was in the States, that the soft drinks seemed to either all be a cola or all be a lemonade type thing. There never seemed to be much of anything else.
There was, I don't know, I actually don't know what the story was about this, but there was for a brief time, this too I think came up at some point when we recorded, but there was something called OK Cola. Which was, you know, which the marketing was basically just something like everything's going to be okay, you know, or whatever.
Oh, it's okay, cola.
Yeah,
it's like the medium cola.
It's not a Coke or a Pepsi, but it's okay.
Yeah, well, and I think it might actually be it's a Coke product.
Oh, interesting.
But and I think, you know, there were rumors that it was, you know, it was a batch that, you know, like a large batch that was made wrong or something, and so they had to find some way to rebrand it.
Go bad.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what I used to think of Dr. Pepper's. Yeah, I always thought there must have been someone else making something else and the recipe went wrong. They thought to sell it anyway.
Yeah.
Could never develop a taste of that.
It's pretty weird. But they, at MIT they had a vending machine. And I think, in fact, they had maybe one of the last ones before they were all pulled. Like the last one that was still available was in the lower corridor of in the basement corridors of MIT. There was an OK Cola machine. I probably even have like a you know, very low-res phone photo of it at some point.
Right.
But, I'm quickly looking up the... Yes, Coca-Cola discontinued tab at the end of 2020.
Oh.
Okay.
I'm sure there's some still out there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm sure you can... I mean, you can certainly buy OK Cola on eBay, you know, if you want. And I'm sure there's probably twice as much tab. But it was terrible. I tried it and it tasted horrible.
In the show chat, Michael's saying that in Quebec you have something called spruce beer, which I've been looking up. Mm-hmm. I think it's flavored with actual like spruce things. I make a Christmas cocktail that's like that, where you take trimmings off your tree and stick it in champagne, you know, with just a simple syrup.
What a waste. Why don't they just eat the bits off the tree?
I suspect it smells better than it tastes.
I don't drink it. I make it for my girlfriend.
I see.
She likes it, so I'm like, sure, have this. It's got a bit of our tree in it.
Herb in the chat says he remembers getting a new Coke can on his doorknob when they were trying to market the new formula. I don't think we were in a test market. I think we just got it, and you know, like, and it was the only option. Like, you know, that was what the uproar was about. Like, they changed the formula, and then you didn't have they didn't have two options. Like it. The introduction of Coke Classic was because they, you know, enough people wanted the old one back.
I remember how quickly the rumors changed to be, oh, they did this on purpose to make everybody upset about it and demand Coca-Cola Classic, and it was all just a conspiracy. Remember how quickly that turned around?
Yeah,
people talking about it that way.
And who knows? I mean, it might be kind of smart.
Giving executives a lot of credit. I'm always like, if it looks like they did something stupid, probably a company just did something stupid.
Yep.
And we're back. All right. So the host's retro competing gift idea was this time again found by Carrington. It is a coffee table book to be called The Art of Point and Click Adventure Games.
Oh, I forgot about this. Right. Okay. Yes, I did find this. Let me see if I can open. You've got a picture. Excellent. So it's one of those art of books. There's lots of those coming out. This looks really lovely to me. So Art of Point and Click. I love point and click video games, especially 8-bit ones. This has the most appeal of all these, the art of books.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the art of Atari, a whole bunch of art of books. But this one really looks nice to me. So I'm tempted.
Oh, they do beautiful publications.
Right? And I don't want to have a lot of stuff, but this just looks like a thing I think I would really enjoy leafing through, like the physicality of this and reading about point and click games and all the really incredible screenshots they're going to put in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right in my alley. I love these kind of games. So boy, howdy, I'm tempted to pull the trigger on pre-ordering something like this.
Yeah.
I think it's, like you said, I think it's not available at the moment, but it's going to be £30.
Mm-hmm.
And
but how much?
£30 book,
yeah.
And it's going to cost $1 a pound. It's going to be £30 book, and it's shipping 1st of July, so not that far off. And that's for the hardcover version, and you get a free PDF as well when you buy it. And
That's a, I like that.
This looks nice.
Because, yeah. I mean, like, I like the hardcover version, but I probably, the most reading I would do would be on the PDF.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, I think this one clicks all the right buttons for me.
Yeah, exactly.
The most recent one that I have bought from Bitmap Books was actually their one on the War of the Worlds with all the new custom art done for it. Another very excellent volume by Bitmap Books.
Yeah, these are crazily well produced books, so I think you're gonna it's gonna be worth the money. It's about whether I want to allocate space to it.
Yeah,
I really just want the PDF, but I do really want to read this. So this is the first one they come out with where I'm like, oh, I think I'm gonna actually buy this because I really want to read it.
Yeah, buy it, keep the PDF, gift the book.
I guess there's always that. I don't actually intend, like I'm not aware of knowing of other things they've done, but it does appear like this is their niche. They do books of this sort. It's thick too. I mean, like they showed a sort of like a side-on photo of it, and it's what 500 pages, something like that. So
yeah, they they've got another one that I think is actually already out, or no, it's coming next year, which is going to be, they're doing one on CRPGs as well. Also, you know, pressing my buttons. So that's the next one I'm going to want to get, I think. I don't know. It might turn me into a collector.
Yeah.
Soon you'll look behind me and you see stacks and stacks of books and a very sad, overburdened Carrington in front of them.
Yeah.
War of the Worlds, that's the one that I've got. The art in that is beautiful.
Nice. All right. So, yeah, so I guess this is a true gift idea for the future gift-giving seasons. It's not quite available, but in plenty of time for whatever winter holidays are coming after July.
Oh, well, exactly. You could buy lots and lots of different ones from them, and then in the gift-giving season, you could give away the ones that you like the least.
Yeah, that sounds good. Or,
the re-gift.
I wouldn't dislike any, but yeah, that keep the ones I like. I really, really, really like. And
tell me what you like. What you really, really like.
The ones which I only like, I'll give away.
I'm sure almost everybody heard that same little thing in their head.
Exactly right.
My job is done. Get that out of your ears for the rest of the day.
Yep. I will try to keep myself from including any part of that in the podcast the feed version.
Like I say, it's all gold, everything I say. History wants to hear every syllable.
That's right.
You have a duty to the future, Paul, to record and save everything I utter.
All right.
Earl has no comment.
Yeah.
He's blanked there. He's blanked out.
Okay. Now we can turn to what is usually an eBay auctions section, where Carrington will talk about something that is not an eBay auction.
Right, indeed. And gift idea was found by me and is not available because it's not out yet. Here's my auction, not on eBay, that's not available because it was already sold. But it was such an interesting little journey. And if we had recorded before, I think it would have been available, but it's my choice anyway. So I was browsing through. I talked a while ago about Max Sold, which is like another auction site where you go to. It's a lot of furniture. It's a lot of downsizing kind of auctions where people just get a whole bunch of lots of things, or they're moving out of a condo or whatever, and it's really hit and miss, and it's really geared towards like local pickup. There's no buy it on Max Sold and somebody ships it to you. It's like, here it is, the pickup is going to be on Sunday between noon and 4, and this is going to be the address, bid if you want. And so it's that sort of local auction. So every once in a while I browse through, and a while back I was browsing through and I found a really cool looking computer. So it comes in this box. It's like a travel box with a bunch of travel stickers on it. And so going through, I'm like, well, what is this thing? What a neat looking computer. It's got two cassette players in the front, a nice looking keyboard, and a single line display. So above the keyboards is this one single line display. So wondering what this was, I sent the link around to a bunch of people, and everybody freaked out saying, oh, it's an MCM70. What? Wow. It's like super, it's the holy grail of Canadian computing or whatever. And so a bunch of people bid on it, ended up going for $5,000. So I don't know if the person who listed it just said, by the looks of the Air Canada stickers, this has been used as a portable computer. includes a newspaper clipping, early machine untested. Like, just that's it. No keywords, no anything. You just got to know what it is from the photos. And so it went for $5,000, and it's totally lovely. The two computers, or two cassette slots, are supposed to have little flip-up mm-hmm. lids on top of them, and they're missing. But it otherwise looks totally gorgeous. Like, it's just a little beautiful thing. So it's from MCM, Canadian company. This computer came out originally in 1972 from Microcomputer Machines, which is based right here in Toronto. Kind of some people say it's the first like truly portable computer because it's like completely self-contained. It's got storage and you can run programs on it. It's got a display and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, every once in a while you can stumble across a real neat find on Mac Sold. So I liked it so much that I kept it as my eBay pick, even though too late for Paul to buy it. And it got bid up from the initial, it was like put on for a dollar. Like if the only person one bid, they would have got it for a dollar. But there was then a feeding frenzy in the last few days as word got out, it went up to $5,000.
Yeah.
But if Paul, bought it, he'd just go and put it over with the other two.
Right.
I think, so I know that we did talk about this before, because I remember, I'm gonna take over the screen for a second.
Do it.
I remember this photo from Wikipedia of the MCM70 with it where the actual cassette doors are on it, because it looks like a face.
It looks like a face. It looks like somebody with those snowblind goggles.
Yeah. Like. It is such a very funny looking thing. Very cool.
So somebody
that you
was
saw it
almost
like
able to pick one up for a dollar in Toronto. But then other people found out about it and ruined the fun.
Well, if you hadn't spread the link around, you probably could have picked it up for a dollar.
It was just me. I think a bunch of people found it. But yeah, I sent it to a bunch of people in Toronto who all got very, super, very interested. But I don't know. I didn't keep track like who was bidding or if maybe somebody I know bought it or whatever. It's untested. It's just a thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad, like we were talking about before, like early machines like this, this easily could have been not noticed by anybody. Be bid for a dollar, nobody bid, and then just chucked in the trash because nobody wants this thing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, hopefully it's gone to a beautiful, privately owned Canadian bomb-proof museum.
Or shortly going to appear on eBay. Who knows? We'll see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, although, I mean, the fact that it went so high on MaxHold suggests that it may not be headed for eBay, just because, unless it really is, like, worth twice that.
Yeah, I don't know what these are worth. I doubt it. I mean, even though it's a super collectible, very early machine, it's untested. It's missing the little slot things.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine how much it would have gone for if it had the cassette covers.
Right? But it could be that these, like, if you want one, there's five known ones or whatever, and you're going to have to pay $5,000. But it's hard to imagine you buy this for $5,000 and it goes for $10,000. You'd be like, how much can this really be worth? I don't know. I don't know the market for them. But hooray for Canadian computers.
It's so early, though. I mean, in the chat, Daniel suggests, you know, it could be a candidate for the first PC. I mean, it is, it's early. It's pre-Apple I, right?
Well, on the vintagecomputer.ca site, they talk about how there's some argument that this is the first, like, non-purpose-built personal computer, because it's got a built-in display, cassettes, and blah, blah, blah. It's one of the first commercial computers that was, like, it's built around the 8008 CPU, but it's also, like, essentially the first one with a operating system with a built-in language that used the MCM, like a version of APL. And so you could create your own programs and store them and stuff. So it's one of the first computers you could buy that's like a fully built computer that you can program and save programs and rerun them and stuff. Like a whole bunch of, for 1972, like super early for that kind of stuff. But it's got that single line 32 character display, and it's like a gas plasma display. Yeah. So not a lot of games can be written for this one.
It's really funny. Like, if I had to guess when this was from, I would have guessed way later. I mean, like, I'm
from the industrial design. Yeah. I would have guessed later. It looks like an 80s computer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see them compile Doom to run on this one.
It's. But I mean, this really does feel like way ahead of its time. I mean,
because it's got a very Apple II feel to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I was just looking at it, I would have guessed late 70s, early 80s.
Canadians are trendsetters.
Yeah.
Well, 1978, if you convert from metric to imperial, is 1972. So
there you go.
I think maybe we say it came out in 1972 American, but that was late 1978 Canadian, I think. So that's why.
I see.
Yeah.
So less kilometers.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm. So that's my choice. Can't buy it. Too bad, Paul.
Oh, well. Now I know. Now I am reminded to look for it.
Right. Check your max sold listings for MCMA 70s.
It is. I mean, like, it is really kind of freaky, though, that it could have gone by. And
yeah,
because
it was
noticing.
Just a $1 bid, no description, and people just say, ho, ho. And even the main photograph, like, on it, like, which is the one that comes up if you browse, like, general auctions, was just the case. They didn't even make the – it was just like, here is a case with a bunch of travel stickers. It looks like a piece of luggage.
Yeah.
So if you didn't – I just was going through because I saw the word computer. So I was like, oh, what, I wonder what computer they're doing. Oh, this is a very interesting computer. But if you're just browsing the listings as they fly, it would just be, here is a piece of luggage with some travel stickers on it.
Can you zoom in on the keyboard for a second? Okay, it's got APL characters on it.
Yeah, interesting. So little Greek letters and symbols.
And slight discoloration of the return key. Yeah. Another one of those things where you get those weird custom keys they have to make, and like the space bar on a lot of computers where it's the one that changes.
Yeah.
Slight discoloration there. But yeah, a bunch of APL symbols. Look at that. Nice.
Reminds me of one of my 3270 APL terminal when I was... supporting that back in the day.
And it looks like you have the APL symbols on the keys, but then all the other letters on the keys, on the main letters on the keys, seem to be italicized.
Right. Strange, huh?
Yeah. Not everything was a good idea there, I guess. But
as if you needed to italicize them to differentiate them from the APL command keys.
Right.
It is. I mean, I guess the V key is a little confusing because it says it has the union symbol above V.
That's right.
But and the O key, I don't know what it is. It's above the O. It looks like it's I don't know what that is, but it's a little circle.
No, I can't remember.
So
many, many decades ago.
All right. So we can probably move on to Earl's eBay auction.
Yep, I've just got one. And it is for some IBM, if I remember right, core memory. And I've noticed that the price of nice examples of core memory have gone up. The prices have gone up over the years. I really like this one, though, because it's in very good condition. And the little metal rings are on the larger side. So when you look at it, you can really see the individual bits.
If I was buying a core memory, and obviously you're not going to buy it to use it, you're buying it as an object, I would want the largest rings possible. Because I'd be buying it for the aesthetics. You want to see the big rings, the toroids being really large. So I would definitely prefer the larger size.
Totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
So you could sit there and actually read the contents.
Or use a little magnet to program it. Yeah. Just going to reach in really carefully and only touch that one.
So I think, what's it going for? $175?
Yeah.
Buy it now?
Mm-hmm.
Or a make offer. I really like the auctions that have a make offer in case you don't want to pay $175. Just offer less, see what happens.
I'll give me $20 to take it off your hands.
I'd be really tempted to, if I had such a thing, to try to work out a way to interact with it. You know, like.
Wasn't there a kit, a shield that you could buy for Arduino?
Oh, I think you might be right. That sounds vaguely familiar.
I don't know if it's still available, but there was an Arduino shield where you could actually use a tiny amount of core memory and actually program it and read from it.
That'd be fun, but if I was doing a weird memory with an Arduino shield, I'd rather have a delay line so I could see the stuff go out. I could run around my condo.
They're very temperamental in terms of temperature and also a little toxic, so...
That's true.
Yeah. You can make a delay line, I guess, out of an HO train and put things in or out of it. Like, it'd be really fun to make a model railroad memory system.
Yeah. Particularly if you're not the one that's got to maintain the refresh.
Exactly. Right. But I'm just thinking, like, is there one of those things where you're loading cargo in or not, and you go by weight or something and go, there you go, got a memory system, and choo-choo-choo, here it comes.
The computer seems really slow today.
I found on Tindy at least one version of this core memory Arduino shield, 32-bit memory for Arduino, for $40.
So it looked like it's still available to buy?
That's a good question. I can add it to the cart. So yeah, I guess so.
Awesome.
So not a lot of storage space, but it's still it doesn't matter really. You get to interact with it.
Right.
No, it's just a practical implementation of core memory, which is, I think, totally awesome.
But it is not as beautiful as the actual one. All right. Who's next? Michael is next.
Okay. Well, we were talking earlier about, I hadn't actually realized that my pick was sort of linked into what we'd been doing earlier. This is the RCA Selectron Memory Vacuum Tube, a 256-bit version. And they only want $8,500 US buy it now. But you can make an offer, Earl. So
That's a lot of money for that. I mean, I don't know what they're worth, but it's just a lot of money.
It is.
That's $34,000 a K.
Yep. When I bring that up, basically they were wanting to install this and they couldn't get, I think, a 4096 version of it going, and they ended up using... forgotten the name already. Williams tubes. So it ended up not being used. And they went with the Williams tube for the storage. And RCA lost interest in the design and project. Funny about that. It shows over on the right. So there's the 256-bit one, like as in the auction. The photo looks familiar anyway. Originally it was going to be a 4096-bit Selectron tube, but they just couldn't get it together.
Should have used Jeffrey's tubes.
Yep.
Okay, Ensign, remember the number one and go into Jeffrey's tube.
Yes.
Yeah, they should have a thing in memory offers not to be confused with Williams Tube or RCA Selectron.
Yeah. Right.
So was this actually not used in production machines? Is that?
Oh, I think that might be the case. Yes, a planned production of 200 of them by the end of 1946. So, yeah, I suppose that there was a limited market for them then, but...
So much money.
Yeah, but it does make some sense out of it if there are that few of them.
It has such a cool name, though.
Yeah.
I just think if you put Tron on the end of most things, it sounds better.
True.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, it's not Select Tube, it's a Selectron.
Tron
Tube.
Radio Shack Tron.
It mentions that the Joniak developers had decided to switch to Core even before the Selectron-based version had been completed. And I like the fact that there is a Joniak computer.
Yep.
I think it's like the ENIAC or whatever, right? Like it refers to exactly one machine. It's not a line of machines. It is a machine.
Wait.
What does it stand for? I think Neumann is in there somewhere. John von Neumann, numerical integrator. And
yeah, you got to throw von Neumann in there.
Yeah, automatic computer, Joniak. Another one of those things where. I think the acronym came first.
Yeah, right.
Cool. Okay, let's see. Oh, it's me.
It's you.
Okay.
It's you. What do you got for you?
Random things. This time it doesn't seem like they're as interesting as sometimes they have been. But anyway, this is a quick letter, which I just thought was interesting. It's a 1992 quick letter version 2 for the Apple Mac. And what it appears to be is... instant word processing for short documents, such as letters or memos, for use with Apple Mac computers, and it's a desk accessory. So it's not it's got like word processor functions, but it comes up as a desk accessory. Part of what I was thinking was that, text edit that comes with the operating system can do a lot of stuff that you would think this was doing. But one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting about it is just its selling point is the orientation that it has toward the production of letters. It has automatic envelope addressing, a built-in address book. It has templates for standard letter forms. And I'm just thinking, I don't think, there are many aspects of this that are now obsolete. And I think a lot of the letter stuff itself is now kind of obsolete. I don't think there are that many letters being written that you would need quick access to write a letter in your Apple menu. So anyway,
but I guess if you did letters, so this comes out according to this box is 1990 is the the date on it.
Okay.
So I guess at that stage, like, you're using System 7, you've got Multifinder or whatever. Maybe it's the case, like, if you spend all your day in something that's a pain to quit and to relaunch is really slow, but mm-hmm. you do have to occasionally do letters, using this being a desk accessory lets you say, no, I can just open this up, do a letter, fire it off, and I stay in my database program or my desktop publishing program or whatever. Because if I have to quit Quark and relaunch it, it's going to be a massive headache.
Yeah.
Not that Quark isn't going to crash on you all the time anyway. So just use those times to launch a letter. But I'm thinking, like, maybe that's what they want. Like, it's I don't understand the appeal of this. I've never even heard of it before.
Yeah. No, me neither. And it was mainly just the multiple levels of obsolescence that I thought was sort of interesting right. about it. But I could imagine that it would be useful at the time when you need to write letters, but I'm just kind of thinking about the fact that this is not a need that I think arises all that much anymore. Let's see.
What else you got?
This other one I have mentioned, I think, the last couple of times.
We've got to do this eventually at Kansas Fest, because yep. this keeps coming up and I keep wanting to play it. Yep. And we should just do Apple II Murder Party.
Yes, I should say what it is the Make Your Own Murder Party. I think it came up once and somewhere across the room I have a copy that I held up to the camera or whatever, but this one's actually opened. That one isn't, so I don't know what's inside. But now I do.
Maybe it's a brick.
Hopefully yeah. this is inside.
Yeah.
It's a really thin brick.
Yep. Anyway, so if you wanted to know, I do think one thing that's interesting about this, Make Your Own Murder Party software is just that, as I mentioned before, when this came up, I didn't know about it until modern days. I mean, like, this certainly did not hit my radar back when it was for sale. So this is like a weird undiscovered little Electronic Arts title.
Recently, my girlfriend and I were talking about what you'd want done with your body after you're dead. Not apropos of anything. Neither of us are anticipating this as an upcoming need, but just something else was on, or TV or whatever. And we said, like, what do you want? And she's like, I never really thought of it before. And she's talking about what she wants. And I hadn't really thought about it either. And I told her what I'd really like is, like, have a wake, but make me like the actual body at a murder party. Like, wouldn't it be fun to be like, King is dead, it's my corpse in the living room, and like stick a knife in me or whatever. And like, she's like, that's so morbid. I'm like, yeah, but how cool would it be, right? Like, hire a company to use me as a prop at a murder mystery party for all my friends. As I'm just like, when you solve the crime, we'll stick me in a refrigerator. Not till then. You don't like the smell? Then solve the crime. Like, I think this sounds a super fun use of my corpse. She disagreed yeah. very strongly, but I think it'd be kind of fun. I mean, not for me, obviously, I'd right. be dead, but it'd be kind of
yeah.
neat.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yes.
So I'm just saying, I'm open to that. If you guys want to use me as a murder mystery prop for a party at Kansas Fest after I'm dead, I give like on camera permission. I think that sounds really cool.
Excellent.
It feels like there's got to be at least a few ordinances that would violate.
Well, that's not gonna be my problem. I'm dead. You guys figure it out.
Yeah, blame it on the guy in the middle of the lounge with the knife in his back. It's all his idea.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, maybe that can be the year that Kansas Fest is held, whatever it is, 10 miles offshore. But, okay. Let's see. Here we go. This one is Computer Associates Simply Tax.
Boo Tax.
Because it was partly I was thinking, we're recording this as it's about to be April, and so it's about to be tax season for many of us, and this is the 1993 version. And I think it's come up before that we have a paired year, so the 1993 is a paired year for 2021, the year you will be doing taxes for, so it could well be that you could use the 1993 tax software for 2021.
But I would assume tax tables have changed, but yes. And when I say boot tax, I mean boot tax. I actually like paying tax. Well, I like it, but I like hospitals and roads and stuff. So yeah. I'm in favor of those. But I have to do both American taxes and Canadian taxes. Well, I have to. Yeah. I have to pay somebody to do both American and Canadian taxes.
Yeah.
So that's why I boo it. So I don't understand my tax. I'm like a poor version of those rock stars who go, I don't know, my taxes were just done by somebody, and then he flew away one day on a plane. Am I in trouble? Like, I have no idea. I have no idea how my taxes are done.
Excellent. Yeah, that yeah. sounds kind of nice.
Probably not a good idea. It's probably not a good situation. I'm like, I don't know. It's very complicated.
Uh, Boy, this is random stuff. Here's another random thing.
Oh, a pin.
It's a pin.
Is that an e-mate?
It's an e-mate.
E-mates?
It
e-mates.
Is. Yeah, I've got a few of those.
A few e-mates or e-mate pins?
Both.
Nice.
Oh,
okay.
Okay, I've never seen a pin before.
Yeah, I don't think I had either. It's so
okay.
E-mate being the kind of like the end point of the Newton line, the Apple Newton. And it looks like a little clamshell iBook. In a way, I mean, like it sort of predated that, I think, but it has the same sort of design. And I had never seen the pin, so I thought it was kind of interesting and strange.
Is this the device that had been kind of like potato chips for you, Paul? Like you couldn't stop buying them, or was that another similar thing?
The thing that you're thinking of, I think, is the what is it called? The Audrey, Ergo Audrey, which is it's like an internet appliance device.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, those were, part of the issue with that is that they come in many colors, and so that, I mean, like that specifically, yeah, there's something about that here. Ergo Audrey. Okay, we can see what these are. I guess there aren't all that many out there, but there's something like five different colors of them. And some are harder to find than others. I think the black one and there's a green one that's pretty hard to find. There's a purple one. What else am I missing?
And being internet appliances are so useful now.
Yeah. You can.
Well, there's still an internet.
That's true. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Technically.
And you can. There is a way that you can kind of root them. You know, like you can reprogram them to run slightly more recent software. So I have done that to one of them. But yeah, I do have the full color set, and I don't think they're very useful. I don't think they're not very powerful computers.
They're 3COM. Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
huh. Fascinating.
So I think the idea was, you know, you would set it in your kitchen and use it to check your email while cooking, or you know, whatever, keep your recipes on it.
Balance your checkbook.
Yeah, it has a little stylus that sticks out the top. It's really weird looking, actually. And two little speakers that are up on the top. It has a kind of a wedge kind of shape or whatever. Anyway, yes. So it was not the e-mate, but it was this that I have a lot of. So someday I'm going to line them up. I'm going to take a photo, and then I'm going to find someone else who wants them, probably. But okay. So I think that's it. I think it's all of the eBay auctions I had. This time, not too weird.
No, not too weird at all.
But
Australia has now completely swallowed Michael.
Yes.
The water's been rising throughout the show.
Yeah.
He is gone. Michael, come back to us. There you go.
He's back.
Hooray.
Bubbles coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
No, just got a email followed by a text message and phone call from the administrator of one of the websites that I host and look after. So it looks like someone's trying to spoof and do naughty things to one of the domains. Mm. So,
uh-oh.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of glad I don't work in information security. I mean, like, I have to pay attention to it, but I don't, it's not usually my fault when some major disaster happens.
Right.
And I think that's
good. Then why does everyone sort of like turn and look at you and go, Paul?
Yeah. All right. So I think we made it through the eBay auctions. And now I guess we're at the closing discussion point. And Carrington, you are first in the alphabetical list.
Woohoo. I think I have nothing. Got the last of the feelies for the text adventure I've been working on, which is nice. So I can take the shot of those because it goes on the back of the box. So the boxes haven't been able to be printed until all the feelies were here. So I can take the back of box photo. So that's where that project stage is at. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only retro computer thing I got going. Other than the last feely was the pin. So speaking of pins,
nice.
The pin finally arrived, the big bag of pins anyway. So finally have all the feelies, can take the product shot in the next couple of days. Send the boxes out for the die line cutting and finally wrap up that project. So that's exciting. I think that's all I got though. Not that much.
Cool. That's all right. Yeah. Earl, any closing thoughts?
No, I think I'm going to pass too. Sadly, I haven't had as much time as I wish to play with the retro computer stuff. Oh, I am going to say on a tangent, though, I'm very happy, Carrington, that you and Kay have decided to keep going, even though the Infocom train has come to the end of the tracks. You guys are still going with Eaten by a Groove, so thank you.
Put out one episode of the first, like, new things with Change the Weather and Uncle Zebulon's Will, and currently both playing the game for the second one of those. So, we're going to keep going indefinitely on that show, which I really, really like. So, super fun.
Cool.
Gives us both an excuse to play games. So.
Yeah,
games.
Yeah, I've got that episode racked up to, I think I've got about three or four other podcast episodes in front of that one.
What?
That's a problem. Yeah.
How dare you?
Not driving to work. My commute, not having the commute time. I don't get to listen to enough
you
podcasts.
You can sit in a dark room and listen to me.
Yeah.
Do nothing else.
30 foot of walking from upstairs to downstairs, you just don't get to listen to too
many that's podcasts. The last couple of years, I go through fewer podcasts and I go through fewer audiobooks because of that. You just have a much longer commute.
Yeah. I certainly have not stopped, adding them to the end of the playlist. It's just that the playlist is now like whatever, a week and a half long if I were to sit and listen to it all through. It's hard to keep up. And speaking of that, those of you who are listening to this,
43 unlistened to episodes of various podcasts.
I use Pocket Casts. That's the one I've generally been using. It works pretty well. I think we had a prior, complaint fest about the lack of the perfect podcast platform. But this one, you can keep a sort of a list of like things you've downloaded, off the net so that you can listen to them in queue. Mine says 999 episodes are in it, but that's because I know that it doesn't actually have that next digit. So,
oh, goodness.
As many times as I add to it, at this point, whenever I add new ones, it doesn't actually increase the number. So, I don't think I'm ever going to catch up.
Wow. See, I use a couple of different podcatchers, mostly because since we make podcasts, I'm always wanting to listen in different things to make sure everything's working. Mm-hmm. But I'm a big fan of a lot of shows. I set to say, keep the latest one. If I fall two episodes behind, I missed one, whatever. I can't keep a queue of 2,000 episodes. It would just become overwhelming.
So podcast
for most shows, I'm like, I will. If I can't get to you, you come out every 3 weeks and it's been 3 weeks,
then
fine, I missed one.
Can't do that with the episodic history podcast.
Sure, episodic ones would be different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But then again, them being so, there's no problem with delayed listening. It's sort of in Revolutions by Mike Duncan, I'm currently three behind current, but I know how the Russian Revolution ended.
Right. It's not going to be spoilers. Don't worry about spoilers.
Yeah.
Mystery's not going anywhere.
Yeah. There's some shows where I'll set it to keep every episode no matter what.
Yeah.
But I'd say, four out of five shows I subscribe to, I'm like, I usually can keep up and listen to every episode, but if I miss one, then I miss one. I have to let it go.
Yeah. And there's certainly ones that are kind of news related or whatever that does, it's pretty weird to go back and listen to something from a year and a half ago. But, I wound up having a bunch of things in my feed that are kind of related to like the Star Wars minute
that's
or whatever.
Why you've got over 1,000 there. You can push them down the list long enough so that when you get round to actually listening to them, they'll be historical podcasts as opposed to current news. Right.
But I mostly listen to retro computer things and gaming podcasts and stuff and comedy podcasts, all of which are fine to just listen whenever. Mm.
Yeah. Right. And
except for the, oh damn, I wish I'd listened to that earlier. I missed out on buying X.
Getting
a ticket to go
buy anything,
see X. I can give you recommendations on bookcases. So that wall behind you is calling out for at least, I think, 4, 5, 6 foot bookcases. Yeah. I wouldn't have any problems fitting those bookcases in, nor filling them.
I'm going to be painting
them
soon, but no bookcases.
That's the other thing. If you put bookcases there, you don't have to do painting.
I like painting.
Oh.
I wonder if it might
so
be interesting.
Where's the
to
red X button on Carrington's window? Click.
Might be interesting to get some of those sort of archival library shelves that where there are more shelves than space.
Compactus.
So you can fit more.
especially the ones that have got the wheel on them for, because they're big and heavy enough to move them. They're great for trapping people in. I remember back in my life insurance company days, the big compactors downstairs, they were so heavy that you couldn't actually move them yourself. You had to crank the wheel on the end of that compactus to move it.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the bank of ones that were there. Yeah, you were supposed to make sure that there was no one in there already removing policy packets before you actually started closing them.
Hmm. Yeah, I think most of the ones I've encountered have either a wheel on them or they're motorized in some way or whatever. You don't.
Oh, motorized
yourself.
Modern.
Yeah. But yeah, that would be pretty freaky though. I mean, like some of those are pretty long, and if it starts getting closing in and you're way down, it's going to be a sprint.
Yeah, the B. Carrington filed under pressed flowers.
Right, exactly, pressed Carrington. Herb in the chat is saying that we had talked previously with the Magic 2.0 books, and because that he got the audiobook version of those. Those are, I haven't listened to audiobooks. I wonder if they're good. That'd probably be a good series to listen to audiobooks. Those are the Scott Meyer books, Off to Be the Wizard and stuff, where they go back in time and use his Commodore 64 to like be a wizard. It's the fun books. I like them.
Yeah. I think you probably mentioned that like a year ago or something, and I've been meaning ever since to read those. I think I even purchased them.
It's not high literature, but they're super fun. Yeah. And they're quick reads. Very quick. If you want something where you can like blow through it fast, it's a good example of those kind of books.
Yeah. And so if someone else went back with a PET or a TRS-80 or an Apple, be a whole new, instead of the War of the Roses, it'd be War of the Magic Machines from the future.
All right, let's see. I have here's a thing that we can use to check off people's bingo cards.
Ooh.
It's probably reversed in the video, but I now have a Yellowstone in hand.
Oh, nice.
It's not in computer yet.
Oh, mine's in transit.
Yeah. So we'll see.
You must be closer to the seller because I bought it on. Did you get yours on day one availability?
Yeah, I think I did. But,
or did you get it early?
No, not early.
I got mine on day one, but I think it's still in country, hasn't made it across the wet stuff yet.
Yeah.
The big wet stuff, as opposed to the little wet stuff here.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So part of why I was interested in that was I wanted to finally try out the FujiNet thing, I've been interacting a little bit with the FujiNet people, and so I guess the work is being done on the Apple II end of it to try and make it possible to have an Apple II FujiNet as well. I guess they're never getting out. Even though the Fuji refers to the Atari logo, I think that is just the name now. And it sounds like what's going to happen is rather than trying to adapt the Atari plugging FujiNet into an Apple, there's probably going to be one sold separately that has Apple related connectors on it because the ports are not similar enough. But so one thing I learned was that the FujiNet, it's actually kind of software. A lot of it is software that runs on a ESP32. The actual brains of it are an ESP32. So I have also gotten a little pile of ESP32s to make little FujiNets with, or at least to attempt to it. Because right now you can't buy an Apple II one, but you can program an ESP32 and attach a little cable to it. Maybe work with the beta software that they're working on. So anyway, that's my project.
They're so cheap. You get little ESP32 development boards for just like a couple bucks.
Yeah. I think it was like $6 or $7 or something. It was small enough that, I mean, I was a little concerned about it because I looked at, I forget, there's a couple of different places that you can get these kinds of parts online. And one of them where there was just sold out. I thought, oh no, are we facing the chip shortage on these two? But I didn't have any trouble on Amazon. But I still got a few just in case they become hard to find. Oh, and we have a question right at the end here. So end of the line, Joel asks about why SSI produced so many games on these home computers, this Commodore 64, PC, and Apple II, when seemingly the sales were low.
Depends what you mean by so many games. They produce a lot of the same game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that may actually have I think that may answer its own question in a way. If you're going to make a profit and nobody's buying like only 40 people are buying this, then
but
you have
buy
to
buy everything.
Yeah, exactly. You have to make a lot of them. And SSI, like, you know, like the Audreys and the Colors, I mean, like, they sort of set themselves up for collectors. I mean, once you have 4 out of 5, you're sucked in. You know, you will get the 5th, you will get all the future ones. But they did, I mean, yeah, they did a lot of things.
Yeah, but they would have had their tool set and everything in place. So, you know, the games are all identical except for the media to load it in. So, you know, all the box, all the rules, everything else is standard. They also have their own standard engines for each of those platforms, and it's just a case of setting it up. So
there were a few variations. I mean, it was, you know,
Of course, they showed the graphic of the best looking system, but
I mean, there's definitely usually on the end of the box it'll say, like, you know, this is related to, you know, this other prior game, you know, but it's now new scenario I forget now. There was I think it was, I'm trying to remember which one this was, but anyway, there was one that was a second step in the series. RDF 1985, I think it was a sequel to Germany 1985. And if you got the RDF 1985 disc, it contained on it an updater for your Germany disc. So, because it was basically the same plus data, you know, like a slight update, and then new data for the new scenarios and, you know, new little cards. But they're pretty cool, although I could not imagine myself actually playing them. You know, it's, I can understand the kind of thinking that would go into it, but it's just, I would feel like my time is not being well spent.
Yeah, I guess you just got to be into that sort of game. Yeah.
No, I'm enjoying playing. I've been getting the older games and playing them. I actually enjoy them more than the current new stuff.
What do you mean older? You mean older SSI games in particular?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I ended up buying Computer Bismarck because I didn't have a working copy, air quotes around the word copy. So,
because that's an early one. That's got to be.
It's the first one.
Oh, is that? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty early.
Yeah, so it still uses a Chinagraph pencil, supplies Chinagraph pencil, laminated maps and things, as well as you get the maps on the computer screen. But,
It was funny. I was about to go look up before you guys, because you guys know everything off the top of your heads. I was going to go look it up on Moby Games, which reminded me something we didn't talk about, but Moby Games just got bought by Atari. Did you guys hear that? Am I supposed to say Atari in quotes?
Yeah. Oh, you just say Atari, dead corpse.
Right. Oh, and here's Paul with his computer business.
Yeah.
I'd show off mine, but it's downstairs in the dry part of the bunker.
Yeah. And in fact, actually, this one, Computer Bismarck, it's very blatantly related to a physical game. The physical game is called Bismarck.
I've got that game, which is basically, you know, it's part, you know, it's naval battles, that sort of thing. That, you know, we used to play them quite a lot back up in Brisbane. But I also recently found my copy of Computer Bismarck that I had actually gone in and hacked RDOS, I think is the operating system that they used. And it's got all my programming and scenario updates in there. But cool. I'm having trouble reading that disk on my Apple Flux. But that's where, as the German, you get reconnaissance aircraft, and you also have the Graf Zeppelin and Tirpitz scenario, where Bismarck, Tirpitz, and Graf Zeppelin basically are all built and ready and do a breakout into the Atlantic. And that's makes for a very fun game for both sides.
Yeah, I'm not very well historically versed in any of this, though I am much more than I used to be because I've been scanning these games. You know.
Oh, yeah, okay. Sure, no doubt.
But yeah.
Well, that's the other thing I liked about these the old games is that they either had a separate book or part of the rules booklet had the historical context of it all. So, but then again, there was no internet to actually sort of like go off on a tangent to find all these things. So I think in Computer Bismarck, it does actually have information on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And things like that.
So. A lot of the SSI games either come with a different book or, you know, it really does seem like this is the kind of game that you write if really what you want to do is write books. But,
yes,
you know, right. these are historians writing games.
Yes, yeah.
So.
And, yeah, I played a lot of Computer Bismarck at university because it was basically a game that you could play quietly up the back of the computer lab and not distract the tutor or whoever was at the front trying to teach something to... they finally figured out if they didn't like pay attention to the people at the back row because they were effectively a resource that the tutor could rely on if they had problems.
Right.
And I was one of the few who was actually allowed to sort of like sit up in the back row when it wasn't my class.
So you could play games during other people's classes too.
Yeah, and also I was also writing programs for other lecturers and things. So, yeah, back in my younger my pre-20s when I was actually writing software.
Uh-huh. One other thing about this.
Now, that was a long time ago.
I don't know if you can see. The box is thin.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this being the
and
first
one. And
it's
still very empty.
Yeah, it's true. There's some space in it. But the real first box, this is a re-release, basically. The real first box is like an inch and a half thick. It's crazy tall.
well, that was that was one of the standard box that even the computer games they were using standard box sizes from the board game era, and that early release there were large format games along that style.
Just found as a big Parker Brothers like Monopoly size. Here's your computer game.
Yeah. I was scanning and stuff. A box for Paperboy. It's a arcade game, and it's similarly. It has I could go get it, but I mean, it similarly has like a 3/4 inch tall box, but like when you open it, there really is nothing. There's like a disc and a little like information sheet, and I don't know why it was so big. Yeah. I mean, like maybe I don't know.
It's difficult since I've been looking at boxes and having to make the decision on boxes for my little game. It's difficult to get die lines other than in standard sizes. Like it's hard to get anything that's just an inch thick.
Yeah.
Or it costs a ton.
Yeah. Same here for one of the projects I'm working on. I looked to try and find boxes that I could use and. I was just going to print my own artwork and then just contact it on. But even just finding white boxes of the size that I want is difficult.
Yeah. If you want a box that's one of Amazon's standard sizes, you're okay.
then you're gold, right?
Anyway, okay. I guess this is all sort of tangents on. On my closing comments.
I was going to say, we've gone down a tangent on the tangents.
Yeah, but I think, speaking back about the ESP32s, I'm interested to try to see if I can make these do something. I mean, like, even apart from the Fujinet, I think it's kind of a neat platform.
Sure, totally.
So,
you can. Mm-hmm. You can usually, with those development boards, program them with the Arduino IDE.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So... It's not too tough to find a good, the Arduino IDE, it has pluses and minuses, but it's very well known. And so in terms of getting some examples or whatever, how to make it do some things, it's not too tough. Some demos even come when you load those libraries into the IDE, so you can just do a little hello world of various types.
Cool. Yeah.
I might have to investigate those because... I have one hardware project, which is rare for me being a programmer, where I'm directly working with the frame buffer on a Raspberry Pi so that I can avoid going into a desktop system and then basically just display the frame buffer to the monitor. So I'll just have to sort of see if one of these smaller ESP or Arduinos, I can sort of like work at the frame buffer level to cut down on the overhead of, because I'm getting too much of a lag between what I'm getting in on the serial port to what I'm wanting to do up on the screen for the output.
So. Yeah, could be. I think what the ESP32 is, the feature that a lot of people like about it is the Wi-Fi.
Okay.
But so I don't actually know what I don't know much about the other specifications. It's, you know, some sort of machine that can run pins and do Wi-Fi.
Okay. I might have a look at it anyway. But
I've come here to run pins, do Wi-Fi, and I'm all out of SSIDs.
All right. Excellent. I don't know what that actually was a quote from. I mean, like it's I think of it as being the Duke Nukem, you know?
Right. I think of it as being from They Live.
Okay.
I've come here to kick ass and chew bubble gum, and I'm all out of bubble gum. Whatever. That's Rowdy Roddy Piper in the movie They Live, which is a classic film.
All right. I love that movie. Does it hold up?
Yeah, it totally holds up. It's one of the all-time great fight scenes in a film.
On a tangent to a tangent, my wristwatch has just told me that a pin has been delivered up at the letterbox, and that's my Image Writer 1 pin for the 1983 release of the Image Writer 1 by Apple.
Pin as in like a pin?
Badge.
Oh, I see. Okay. you're redoing that. Yeah. I just need that one pin.
No. I think this one's about a 2-inch or a 1 3/4-inch round badge pin for the Apple Image Writer 1 release.
Cool.
Excellent.
I've never seen that anywhere before, so decided I must have it.
Hmm. Excellent. And now you do.
Well, as long as there's not a brick
or a brick.
Mind you, it is difficult to tell between Image Writer 1 and a pallet of bricks.
Yeah.
The bricks are way less. That's right.
Okay. We've been trying to end for 20 minutes, and I think maybe we should probably do it.
It's just like those dinner parties where everyone's hanging around outside saying goodbye.
Yeah. Okay, and by the way, Herb would like to see photos of your pin. So.
Okay.
All right, that'll do it. That is it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com.
I think I just scrolled off screen.
Still looking for that red X button on Carrington's window.
You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCRpodcast. You can send feedback to...
Where if you're a spammer, you will be deleted very quickly.
That's right. Do not be a spammer. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And you can write a review on iTunes if you wish, I suppose. Until next time,
Retro Compute!